Hello everyone, welcome back to Collider Physics. Today what I'd like to try to do is, because I'm an experimentalist, I want to try to relate better to you how you go from the step of, you know, the quick Feynman diagram calculations where you calculate cross sections to take then into account all the experimental considerations. Because of course we don't see quarks or gluons in our detector. What we see are particles like protons and we see electrons. And so there has to be some sort of translation between what's happening in the hard scattering with what we actually detect in the experiment. And I mean, we've all been guilty of making plots like this one. Proton-proton collision event, you know, you just go up and you quickly draw a few lines. You say, okay, I have two protons coming in, they collide, boom, out comes a bunch of other particles that we represent as tracks. And then we can maybe put in little jets when things are collimated, but even that creation of that jet is a little bit of a construct. I mean, it's up to us how we want to build an algorithm that's going to try to join things together and say, okay, this probably all belongs to a common source, a common particle. And even if we go fancier, so this is a beautiful event display, you can see that we still carry over a little bit our prejudice in terms of what we do, even when we do it more than just with a pencil, but if we'd actually do it electronically. This is a beautiful display. And looking at the display, I can very quickly tell you, aha, you know, there are two muons, one, two, and red. I see a couple of jets, and also this dotted line here, which is missing transverse energy. These are all things that we're going to talk about today. So that's the cartoon version. This is actually what happens inside a collision. What we're really interested in, what we're really interested in is this hard scattering event. What actually happens is a bunch of other stuff. And even here, if you look, you look at this hard scattering, you have a gluon with a gluon, but it's not actually a gluon with a gluon, because the thing that actually came from the proton started its life as a quark, and then it radiated a gluon, and it's the gluon that actually interacted with the gluon coming from the other proton. So you have initial state parton showers, so in blue. You have the thing of interest in red, the hard scattering. But even after you've had that scattering, things can still happen. You can have all kinds of parton showering. So as it comes out, you have gluons making more gluons or producing quark-antiquark pairs. Then the next step afterwards is fragmentation. So it goes, it's a transition from partons to hadrons. And then these hadrons often decay into other things. And that's actually what you see in the detector. You see all this stuff out here. But really what you're interested in is what's happening here. And then I think there was a question last time. Somebody pointed out, yeah, but what about the rest of the proton? What happens to that? Well, a whole bunch of other stuff happens to that, because you still have the leftovers from the original proton that that can themselves interact, producing maybe some softer stuff. It's not what you're interested. You're interested in the hard scattering, but they themselves can produce other particles, and this is called the underlying event. So I'm going to try to explore a few of these concepts in the next few slides. Okay, my next buzzword then is the hard scattering. So it is this part here. So let's look at the hard scattering. So when we have inelastic collisions, they tend to be mostly dominated by soft interactions. And occasionally you'll get a hard scatter producing some new particle like a Z boson or a W boson or a Higgs boson. One thing you have to realize, you know, when we say, oh, the LHC, run two, we had 13 TeV collisions. That's not entirely true, because 13 TeV is the highest energy that you could have a collision. But in reality, what you have is you have a parton in one of the protons carrying a fraction of the energy of the proton. Then you have a parton come from the other proton, also carrying a fraction of the energy, And it's those two fractions that interact with each other. So you have an effective root s, it's the center mass energy, actually ends up being less than the 13 TeV that's available to you. Now, depending on what the fraction is, the interaction can be quite soft, or if the fraction is very significant, you could have most of that 13 TeV. So that's one thing to remember, is that though we say 13 TeV, since the partons only carry a fraction of their parent hadron's momentum, the available center of mass is an effective one. It's smaller. So if we want to describe this hard scatter right here, you have to think of it as, first of all, there's the cross section for the hard scatter to happen, but then you have to convolve this with the fact that both of these partons come from the proton and they carry some momentum fraction, and that momentum fraction can change depending on which parton you're involved with, which one scatters. So the total cross section is actually convolution between the hard scattering, sort of the underlying cross section, and the two distributions here, which are called parton distribution functions, that describe what's happening inside the proton. All right, so now you've had a hard scattering. Boom, you're lucky. Out comes some particles out of your hard scattering, leptons and hadrons that are produced from the fragmentation of the parton. So basically now we're talking about this stuff out here. All right. So again, let me show you here I'm just way too close to this. It's hard. All right, let me show you here. All right, again, here we have one parton that's carrying a fraction of the proton's momentum, and then another parton producing collimated sets of particles, which we call jets. One thing to note is in the azimuthal direction, so in this direction here, cross sections tend to be independent of that azimuth. You know, it's whether you produce them, if you're like this, whether you produce them here or here or here, it doesn't really matter. It really is symmetric in azimuthal angle. One big difference, or one thing you have to realize, even though, you know, when you put two hands together and you say, okay, it collides, even that is an oversimplification, because you remember one of them carries a fraction of the one proton's momentum, and the other one carries a fraction of the other one. If one is really big, see this big arrow here, it's carrying a big fraction of that proton's momentum, and this one is carrying a smaller fraction, what you end up having is every collision is boosted in one way or another. So if this one is really big and this one's small, you're producing stuff in this direction. If this one is bigger and this one is smaller, you're producing things in that direction. So you don't have, unless you're really lucky and it's exactly half the same, you never have this kind of collision. You always have this and this. And this is a big difference from E plus E minus machines, because E plus E minus, they're fundamental particles, right? So you're not striking something that's inside the electron with something that's inside the other electron. So when electrons collide, they go like this. And when you have protons colliding, sometimes they go like this and sometimes go like that. And that actually causes some difficulties that I'm going to explain in just a second. But I want to just maybe define a few more variables to figure out if a collision is a hard scattering. We often use the transverse momentum, so PT. And that PT, so if you have a jet with a large PT, then you have more confidence that this comes from a hard scattering than if you have a jet that's produced from a smaller PT. So large momentum transfer means small distances, which means hard scattering. So it is a signal, and we are criminals. We often say transverse energy, and your first thing would say, but energy is a scalar, how can it be a transverse? It's kind of a sloppy way of saying, I'm measuring things in my calorimeter. My calorimeter is giving me energy, but I do have directionality because I saw my jet going in this direction. It's depositing energy here or here. So I'm kind of mixing in things related to direction, which is more momentum-based, with energy, which is something that I measure in the calorimeter. One important thing you have to keep in mind, large energies do not imply hard scattering. It's large transverse energies that imply. So if I go back here, this interaction here has large energies, but it has small transverse energies. So what's happening here, so you could have a lot of the proton left over interacting, but it doesn't mean that I have a hard scattering event. So if I want to look at hard scattering event, I need to look at the transverse energy. The other thing you want is angles, or maybe you want angles between jets. Now, theta is not a good variable for us. Why is that? Because every event is boosted. It looks different. So even though you would think everything is the same in the sense you have a jet, theta is not a good quantity. So instead, we use something called rapidity. So angular separations in theta are not invariant under longitudinal boosts because a given set of hadrons will appear more collimated just depending on the boost. It has nothing to do with really the hard scattering event. It's just related to the fact that it might be boosted. So we use this thing called rapidity. Rapidity is great. It's additive under Lorentz transformations. Rapidity differences are also boost invariant. So we use rapidity. And sometimes we also use something called pseudo-rapidity. Now, in the limit of massless particles, m going to zero, rapidity and pseudo-rapidity is the same definition. The only time when you have to start being careful is if you're just talking about massive particles. So, for example, W bosons, Z bosons. It would be very sloppy of you to talk about the pseudo-rapidity of a W boson because it's a really massive object. But to talk about the pseudo-rapidity of an electron or a muon, good enough because they're a very light object. So rapidity for us is, so if you have a collision like this, eta is equal to zero is right above you, and it's kind of a funny scale. This is eta is equal to zero, one, two and a half, infinity. So basically it goes, it sweeps more and more quickly. So for example, eta is equal to one is about, theta is about 40 degrees. 2.5 is about 10. 8 is equal to 5, which is roughly the edges of our detector. It's about 1 degree above the beam axis. So what you will see is usually up to 8 is equal to 5. So delta R is an invariant, and that's a great variable to start assembling jet fragments. So if you want to do jet algorithms to see if you have things coming out, whether they are collimated, delta R being the difference here, pseudo-rapidity if they're massless objects. Otherwise, you should use rapidity. All right, so that was the hard scattering. Now let's look at the underlying event. Here's another view here. All right, here's the hard scattering. So let's say you have two protons colliding, and out goes the two hardest scattered jets that come out of the event. So this would be our hard scattering. And then all the other stuff underneath is the underlying event. So this underlying event has two kinds of components. The underlying event can have hard components associated to them. So for example, if you have a parton that emitted initial state radiation, that can be quite significant. But it's not part of the hard scattering event because it's an initial state radiation. So that could be part of your underlying event. Also, the underlying event has beam remnants. So it was asked yesterday, what about the leftovers underneath? So these are all the other bits of the proton that come through. Maybe they'll interact a little bit. And this is also part of the underlying event. So if you think about it, you can see maybe what the problem is in all of this. You're interested in the hard scattering, so you want to know what is the energy of the jet that came out of your hard scattering, but you got all this other stuff underneath. It's kind of like grass under the tree. And so if you want to know what the energy of your jet is, you better know what all this other stuff underneath is, so you can subtract it, and so you get really what the energy is. The other thing is, if it's a hard enough component of an underlying event, it might even make jets in your detector. So you see a jet, you go, yay, I have a jet. But it's not a jet from the hard scattering. It's just noisy stuff that you need to take care of. So this underlying event is very hard to describe. And in fact, I think it's just too complicated to to be described by perturbative QCD. So there are phenomenological models that are used, but all these models tend to be horribly wrong in the sense that often the normalization is very wrong. So you have a model, but then you need the data to sort of normalize your model. Yeah?
Anything that's like infrared and collinear, is it always like assigned to the underlying event or?
So it depends very much also on how you do your algorithms for clustering the jets. Yeah, that's all part of the decisions you make when you decide to cluster a jet. So let me give you just a brief example of how you would go and measure this underlying event. It's important, as I said, because it's the background to jets. It produces jets that you're not really interested in. And in a little bit, I'll be talking about missing transverse energy. And this is also noise around this missing transverse energy. All right, so it generates ET flow under this hard scattering. So you might then ask the question, how do you measure underlying event? Because underlying event sits under the hard scattering, but hard scattering also sits on top of the underlying event. So how do you separate the two components? So what you would do, for example, is you would take a well-defined process, something that's fairly clean, like a Z boson being produced. So you have the Z boson, you have, maybe it's best if I go back to this old diagram here. Let's pretend that this is a Z boson being produced, going off in this direction, and then you have some hadronic recoil, some other stuff being produced against the Higgs, in the opposite direction from the Z boson. But then you have all this region sort of in between here, where it's not part of the hard scattering. So it's kind of like transverse. So this is what you would do. You would select events, Z boson production. Here's my Z boson, here's my hadronic recoil. I would call this the toward and the away direction. And then I would find some space I would define on the transverse region, and I try to measure the activity that's here. And that activity is a measure of what the underlying event would be. Now it's not perfect in the sense that, you know, maybe you don't have just one Z boson and one jet. Maybe you have one Z boson and two jets or three jets. But it's a good place to start, let's say, to find a region where it should be reasonably quiet in terms of the hard scattering. So here I have a plot of basically it's a transverse momentum of the activity that's happening in these transverse region here. In green, I have the data. The dotted lines are various models. Here's the ratio of the two. And you can see that these models, first of all, at quite high transverse momentum, they're quite wrong. They're about 20% wrong. And then once you start going to quite low transverse momentum, they could be pretty much anything. So you really need to make a measurement of that. And actually, that's one of the very first things. Every time the LHC goes to new energy, 7 TeV, 8 TeV, 13 TeV, 13.6 TeV, the very first thing we try to do is measure this, because this sits under everything else that we need to do. All right, I want to talk a little bit about detector physics. Not going to go and talk about, you know, oh, let's take a screwdriver and put together a detector. I don't do that. It is quite fun, though. But what I want to do is I want to relate a little bit the objects that you use, for example, in your phenomenology when you make calculations, with what is actually observed in the detector. And I want to show you some of the challenges related to that. This is a very generic detector. They all kind of look the same detector. I mean, they aesthetically look different, but what they do is basically the same. The detector is basically like a big onion. So imagine you take this onion and then you sort of roll the onion out. The very central part, so the heart of the detector, is our tracking chambers. What it does is it tries to identify charged particles versus not charged particles. So it's already the first piece of information. So imagine I have a gun and I can shoot some photons, some electrons, some muons, some pions, and protons. And neutrons. Photons and neutrons not being charged will just go through and leave no trace. Charged particles will leave some trace there. And on top of that, inside our inner tracker, it's a magnetic field. So it will actually tell you also if it's positively charged or negatively charged. So by itself, it won't tell you if it's an electron or a pion or a muon, but it will tell you if it's a charged particle and what the charge is or not. Then you have another layer, the electromagnetic calorimeter. And the job of that layer is to say, is the particle what we call electromagnetic particle, meaning an electron or a photon, or not? So let's keep following the trace here. You have an electron. It left a trace in the tracking chambers because it's charge, and you'll get the charge out of it because of the magnetic field. Then electrons and photons will deposit basically all of their energy in this layer. Then you have another layer afterwards. This is the hadronic calorimeter. And this tells the difference between a photon that deposits energy here, or a hadron, which will have deposited most of that energy in the next layer. And this is kind of cool because now you can start telling the difference between particles, right? You have enough information. Say, energy here, no tracks, it's a neutron. Or energy here, charge, it's an electron. And then finally, there's one more layer, which is muons, because they're very penetrating. Muons, they make it all the way out of the detector. So they get detected in this layer here. So that's how we can figure out what all the particles are, because nobody shows up with a little name tag saying, hi, I'm a muon. And so we need the interpretation. Now, this is a very gross oversimplification, what I just told you. And in a second, I'll show you where the challenges are. But that's the role of each of the layers of the detectors. So whether you look at ATLAS or CMS, doesn't matter which detector, they all have layers like this. Now, ATLAS, for example, when it was designed a long time ago, ATLAS thought that a lot of the interesting physics we'd be doing would be involving things like electrons and photons. So we have a really awesome electromagnetic calorimeter. CMS thought that a lot of the interesting physics would come out of muons, and so they have a really awesome, they have a really powerful magnetic field here to actually measure muons very well. But in the end, they all do the same thing. Yeah.
I've always been curious, is the muon chamber like filled with some sort of like inert gas, or does it use like photodiodes?
So you can have different technologies. Most of them, what you'll have is you'll have some sort of gas. The muon will go through, will ionize the gas, and then it gets picked up by some string, basically, that's going to pick up the charge. Yeah, that's right. There are different technologies, but that's kind of the basic one. I have a little video to show you the differences. All right, so this is a little video. Imagine you have like just a slice of ATLAS. So the protons come in like this, and then they collide, and out come some particles. And I'll show you just what each of the particles do as they make their way through the detector. All right, here we go. We have an electron, came through, was detected in our inner detector, deposited energy in the electromagnetic calorimeter. Next thing is we have a photon, didn't leave any trace here. But so they look very similar, except that one is charged and one it isn't. Here we have a proton, left trace, most of the energy over there. Neutron is charged, so it leaves nothing, and basically it leaves most of it in there. And there's your muon. It just powers right through and, in fact, would make it all the way out. So you can see by the characteristics. Now, there are, of course, a lot of details in terms of in this inner tracking system, you want you're following the path of the charged particle. So you want to have lots of layers because each layer gives you information about where it's going. And if you wanted to know how close our detector comes to the interaction point, it's about 3 centimeters. So you have an interaction, 3 centimeters later is the first ATLAS detector to see the particle.
Yesterday you told us about the triggers. Could you say
So indeed. So remember I mentioned yesterday the triggers. There are two levels of triggers. There's the what we call the level one trigger. This is the trigger that sits right on the detector. That type of trigger mostly uses information from here, the calorimeter, and from the muon. Both of these, calorimeters and the muons. And so it can look and say, I see a big energy deposit here. Interesting, pass it on. Or I can see a trace just in the muon spectrometer or multiple traces. Really interesting, pass it on. Or if it's just, you know, little sprinklings of things in there, not interesting. So that's the level one. It'll use this information and this information to make a decision as to whether there's like a high energy particle. And then at the second level, where we actually have a little bit more time, it'll do more refined searches. So in a way to do it really fast at the first level is that it can look in a big block and say, okay, in this big region, I see something. But at the high level trigger, so the second level, it can start making more refined searches. So it says, okay, let's not look in such a big place. Let's look maybe in more smaller spaces. Let's see, is it associated to a track? Because it's got a whole half second to do these kinds of decisions. So it will take smaller regions, so more refined, and also track information. And then only after this decision, after the second level, will it finally make the decision whether or not it wants to store information. And over the years, we got really fancy. And we're actually starting to make really cool triggers. Like, you know, I said, okay, is there some... Let's look at the muons, for example. Is there something in the muon at level one? But now it can do cool stuff like, I see a muon here, I see a muon there. I can do like the reconstruction to see if there's an interesting mass. Like, is it a Z boson? And it can do it so fast that it can be done at the first level. So you can start, and that's great because it means that you're really refining, you're better at rejecting bad stuff already at the first level. These are called our topological triggers. So I can look and say, I'm a trigger, I'm looking for three electrons and a muon. Or I'm looking for two muons, a jet, and it has to have an energy at least 100 GeV. So it can do that and to make a decision at the trigger level. Thanks for asking. All right, here's Atlas. I want you to see this tiny little person right here who is not wearing his helmet. This is very, very forbidden. So this is about 80 meters. This is the beam line right here. It's about 80 meters. This is at about 100 meters underground. Basically, it's a big camera. If you can come during the winter when the experiment is open, you can come and visit it. And when you come and visit it, you actually come out on this level, and then you get a face like his face. And you open their doors like, and it really is very impressive. Okay, so it's about 44 meters like this, about 25 meters high, and it weighs about as much as the wrought iron of the Eiffel Tower. It's about 7,000 tons. So it's very big. And all of this that you see here just came down two holes in the roof, one piece at a time. Really cool because all of this was designed in the 90s. I want you to think about software in the 90s. Each of these pieces was built in a different place, a different country. And so basically we'd say, all right, you're Israel. You're going to make some of these here. All right, and you're going to be Italy. You're going to make some of these things. And then we would tell you, you have exactly this much space to make your detector, and you have exactly this much space. Because when we put the two of you together, they have to fit. We can't take a chainsaw and cut through. So in the 90s, this was amazing, that you'd have the software to be able to do all that stuff. But, okay, dinosaurs in the 90s. Okay, so here that's, you have protons coming through on either end, and in the center you have your collisions. The most important aspect about Atlas is a collaboration of people. About 6,000 people. Out of that, about 2,900 of them are authors on our publications. And the way that you get onto a publication, let's say, well, you know, because you're an Atlas person, I think, right? So, you want to be an Atlas author, right? Don't you? All right. And I say, well, you know what? Somebody here before you built this thing, wrote all the software, you know, took a bunch of data. If you want to become an author, you need to spend a year doing common good work, you know, contributions to Atlas in general. And in exchange, after the end of one year, you will become an author, and you're an author for as long as you like. So in exchange for contributing to the common good, you become an author. And as a result, that's why we have about 2,900 authors in alphabetical order.
Kind of like the
Warbunch, you think? Yeah, sorry. Yeah, it's a big kibbutz. We're big kibbutz. We're all friends here. So coming, when I say from 40 different countries, we're talking about the institute that you come from, you know, that you work for. It's 40 different countries. But if you do it by passports, we have about 100 different countries in Atlas. And at any given time, we're training 1,200 PhD students. So we get a lot of theses out of this. And you can see the breakdown as over the years. So that's the most important aspect of Atlas, is it's the people. All right. Now I want to tell you the difference between electrons and jets, because there are some really significant fundamental differences. I mean, of course, hadrons versus leptons, but also it has a really big difference on how you see things in the detector. Now, if you were to open a textbook on how an electron loses energy, there's a whole bunch of different mechanisms. But in Atlas, the energies of the electrons are so high that basically it's just one mechanism that dominates. It's called Bremsstrahlung. All right, so breaking radiation in German. What it is an electron comes along and radiates a photon. Now, that photon could then pair produce and produce E plus E minus pair. And then each of these electrons and positrons can themselves lose energy through a radiation of a photon, and so on and so on. So you have this little cascade. So here's a diagram of what it would look like if you have an electron coming here, and then it hits part of the detector, and then you start having this cascade of things. You start to have more and more particles. So we want to somehow quantify the shape of that, because it's going to define how you build a calorimeter, right? How your electrons are going to look like when they interact. So the parameter that we use is called the radiation length. It's the mean distance of which the electron loses all but 1 over E, you know, E 2.7, not electron, of its energy due to Bremsstrahlung. So it's the distance that this one would have to travel in order to lose all but 1 over E of its energy. Now, of course, in the meantime, it could have produced a whole bunch of other particles, and they themselves travel, and they themselves lose energy, etc. All right? But this radiation length for, let's say, an electron, in traveling through lead, because our calorimeter is mostly lead, is pretty short, actually. X0 is about 0.6 centimeters. So electrons quickly lose their energy in massive stuff. But as I said, you have not just the original electron to consider, but you have all the other electrons that are being produced afterwards. And here is the fraction of energy deposited as a function of how many x0s, what distance you've traveled through the material. And then this is a maximum at around 5. All right, so you start losing a little bit of energy, and then more. When you're at 5 x0s, it's a peak, and then it starts to go down. And you can sort of see by this how big a calorimeter needs to be in order to capture all the energy of an electron. It needs to be at least about 20 x0s. All right, and in fact, a 20 x0s for lead captures about 95% of the electron energy. So ideally you want it to be a little bit more than that, because 95% is not perfect. But so that gives you the scope of the length of this object there. And then transverse, we have the Molière radius. And if you want it to contain 95% of the shower in the transverse direction, you need to go to about 1 Molière radius, which is about 3 x0. So that kind of quantifies what an electron looks like. It's about 20 x0s in length and about 3 x0s in width. So it's narrow and long, but not so long. Now, so you would say, cool, the x0 for lead is 6.6 centimeters. I need 20 of those. So all I need is a little calorimeter that's about 15 centimeters, and I've contained all my electron. But the whole point of a calorimeter is not to contain the electron loss, it's actually to measure its energy. So you need to actually add in things that are going to enable you to measure the energy of your electron. So the way that we do it is we have something called a sampling calorimeter. So you have an electron coming along. Here it comes. And then it's going to hit a layer of something really heavy, like lead. It's going to start showering. And then you have a little break, and you have some other medium here. We use liquid argon, but to measure what the energy is there. And then we let it go through to the next layer. It loses more energy. Then you measure, loses energy, measure. And at the same time, not only do you end up measuring, you have a sense of the energy of the electron, but you also have a sense of its shape if you have sufficient granularity when you measure it. So that's kind of the cartoon. This is actually what our calorimeter looks like, because we don't have a square detector. We have a cylindrical detector. And we want to make sure that that detector, when the electron goes through, basically this, the amount of hard material and, lead and liquid argon, basically, you want this ratio to always be the same. And so we have this nice accordion shape, and I can show you a little movie of what happens when you have an electron coming through. Here's our electron coming through. It just starts its life as being an electron. Oh, then it starts producing electron-positron pairs and bremsstrahlung, etc. And so you can see that the shower that comes from an electron is narrow but long. And then if you built your calorimeter right, the energy of the electron peters out by the time you're finished, the calorimeter, and so everything is contained in there. And one of the beautiful things about electron is if I take an electron that's 100 GeV, it's going to look very much like another electron that's 100 GeV, which is going to look very much like another electron's GeV. So basically, electrons of the same energy look almost identical. Did you want to ask a question? No?
The geometry of like how these things are layered. Mm-hmm. So is it that each layer can like receives a signal and then it doesn't tell and then it can't tell the differences?
So it's designed in such a way that if you were to take a cross section, it would the ratio of lead to liquid argon is going to always be the same as it goes through the detector. So basically, if you had a square thing like this, you could say, all right, ratio of this to this is always the same. But because it is a cylinder rather than a square, you want to have a geometry in this case so that it's always uniform. So it always goes through the same amount of lead, same amount of liquid argon, same amount of lead, so that you're really sampling uniformly the shower. So an electron, they all look the same for the same energy. Now the clever people among you who've been paying attention to something like this, you'd say, but wait a second, you're only seeing part of the electron. You're only seeing this part of the electron. This is not an active material here. It's just used to shower the electron. So if you were to start adding this plus this plus this, you're not going to get the total energy of your electron. You're only going to get the bits of energy that you're measuring, which is in between here. So how do you go from the bits to the total energy of the electron? And this is where we thank Mother Nature for providing these beautiful standard candles like the Z boson. Z boson is awesome. I'm going to talk about it so much, you're going to be sick by the end of my four lectures. I love the Z boson. It's so versatile. And one of the beautiful things about the Z boson is that it's produced, and on shell it has a mass, which is about 91 GeV. And then it produces electrons. So I can imagine if I identify a Z boson and I look at these electrons, and then I go look over here, and I say, okay, these electrons came from a Z boson, but I'm not adding up to the total, which is the invariant mass of the Z, I just correct for it. So basically, if it's a Z boson, then I'm just going to correct this energy until I get exactly the right mass, because I know it's a Z boson. So for higher energy electrons, let's say 25 GeV or more, we can use this. For lower energy electrons, nature gave us another beautiful standard candle called the J-psi. J-psi, just like the electron, just like the Z boson, decays to two electrons. But the mass here is much smaller. It's about 3 GeV versus 90 GeV. So we use this to calibrate our electrons that are just a little bit of energy. And then we use this, we can calibrate electrons up to about 100 GeV that way.
Sorry, I'm
What's JSI?
JSI is it's just a hadron. I mean, it's a particle state, you know, JSI, upsilon, rho, pi zero. It's just another one of these two quark states.
Sorry, I'm not sure I understand this.
Yeah.
So you have this layered detector,
mm-hmm.
and you see some amount of energy deposited there, and you say this doesn't amount to the full energy of a Z.
Yeah.
But how do we know it came from a Z? Do we see it?
So I can, before I built my detector, I took my detector into a test facility that, for example, produces electrons of a certain energy, so I can calibrate that way. So that sort of takes me a lot of the way, because the accelerator says, I'm going to give you 100 GeV electrons. What do you see on the other side? I see 80 GeV electron. Okay, so you already, you know, you're kind of like 20% off, so you've got to correct for that. And then you go the rest of the way for high precision. You say, okay, I have two electrons. They added up, but the mass of the Z ended up being 85 instead of 90. Okay, then let's correct the electrons to give us the rest of the way. All right. Yes?
Would you need to see, like, two tracks of electrons to...
Yeah, you do.
You do that with, like, the W bosons if you only see, like, one electron
so-
track?
So the W bosons is an interesting problem because it has only one electron. It's not a fully reconstructed state. But once you've calibrated an electron, it doesn't matter where it comes from. So you can calibrate it using Zeds, which are easy to calibrate. And then whatever calibration factors you got to correct for your electrons, you just apply them to the W boson. Yeah. Yeah.
At these high energies, especially I would think that the electrons is electron-positron.
Mm-hmm.
are quite boosted,
mm-hmm.
so quite collimated. Is there a high resolution to
so whether yeah. So when they're sitting on the Z peak, it's not so bad. And if you're on shell, but of course if the Z boson itself is very boosted, then yeah. And there are all kinds of algorithms that that look at what happens as you get two electrons that come very close. How do you divide the energy between the two, for example? And this is where actually in ATLAS, this is not the same thing in CMS, because we have such great calorimeters. If you're looking at super high energy events, not a Z to EE, but you're looking for a Z prime, like a fancy particle that doesn't exist, or as far as we know, Z to EE is easier for us to do in ATLAS than Z to mu mu, because the calorimeter is so good and is able to tell them apart. Muons start to get so energetic that they hardly bend in the magnetic field anymore, and then it's hard to tell them apart. Yeah.
So are you reading scintillation light from your liquid argon layers?
So it's an ionizes. So you have a liquid argon, the particle goes through, ionizes the gas. The scintillation light is...
readout as well.
Sorry?
And then you have some pixelated charge readout to give...
So you have the granularity of the detector reads out, and in fact you have different granularities depending on where you are on the calorimeter. Very close, you want very fine granularity, because one thing we'd love to tell apart is a pi zero to gamma gamma, two photons. So you want to be able to see the two photons that are very close together. Then you have another layer which is really big that just is there to collect energy, basically. And the scintillating light is actually the next technology for the hadronic calorimeter. So there we have steel and scintillating light. All right, hadronic showers. I want to do myth busting. Now, if we go back here, when I said this here, you should have said, that's a load of BS, and I don't mean beyond standard model. This is a gross oversimplification. Oh, life would be so great. All of my electron energy falls here, and all of my proton energy falls here. Wow, isn't life great? No. Mother Nature is sneaky, and I want to show you why. This is what a hadronic shower looks like. So imagine you have a proton coming along here, and then it starts to interact with the material in your detector. And look at all the types of things that can happen. It can produce pi zeros, which decay. It can produce kaons inside the shower. These kaons can decay to muons. Muons, you get muons coming from protons. Neutrinos get produced. Neutrinos, once they're produced, they're out of here. Now, let me ask you the question. Let's say you have a proton coming along, and then right away, you're unlucky enough that the first thing it makes is a pi zero. What happens to that pi zero? 100% of the time, basically.
It decays to two photons.
What are two photons? They're electromagnetic particles. From then on, they don't go back to being hadrons. From then on, they're photons. So you could have a proton coming in, hadron, and if you're unlucky enough, the first thing it does is it produces a pi zero, and from then on, it looks exactly like two photons. So hadronic jets can look like electron or photons. The other way around is harder. But just because, if you're unlucky, everything becomes electromagnetic energy from the start, and then off it goes. So in fact, in a hadronic shower, about 50% of the visible energy in a shower actually comes from electrons and photons. So this picture here, which was BS, actually, it deposits quite a bit of energy here. Now, in exchange, it will deposit some energy here, not always, but often more here. But you do actually have energy deposition already in the first layer. Okay, so that's already 50% of your shower is actually electromagnetic in nature. Then you get another quarter of your shower is ionization coming from the particles it's produced, so pions, protons, muons. Then another quarter of the energy comes from nuclear breakup and excitation. So for example, if you're producing a neutron here. And then another 2% you never even measure because they're neutrinos. When they're neutrinos, they're gone. So that is kind of the anatomy of a hadronic shower. You only get to see actually part of the energy in the first place, just a second, and a lot of it is electromagnetic.
If you look at the vertices of these electromagnetic showers coming from the hadronic process, can you tell the difference from other kinds of showers coming directly from an electromagnetic process?
So we don't have the granularity in our hadronic calorimeters to be able to really to tell these vertices apart, right? What we try to do is we try to have multiple layers in our calorimeters so we can sort of see what it looks like at each sort of a few, you're sampling basically through. And we do have things like, for example, I didn't explain, but we do have something called a pre-shower that sits in front of our calorimeter. And that, if something happening in there already from the start, you know right away that you have, for example, a pi zero or photons. So because the moment it hit, you have energy, then it must be electromagnetic in nature. So it's harder to do because we don't have the precision like our tracking detector. I mean, usually our calorimeters are quite... To build a calorimeter that would be able to see all the vertices, first of all, you need a lot of money. Yes, you could if you could get a better anatomy of the shape of the object. Now, similarly to what we had here, where you had parameters that talk about sort of the length of a shower and the width of a shower, you have an equivalent thing for hadronic showers. So we have the nuclear interaction length. It's the characteristic distance for hadronic interaction. So it's the distance on average that hadronic particle would travel before it goes through an inelastic nuclear interaction. So in lead, which is what our calorimeter is mostly made of, it's about 17 centimeters. Remember the other one, X0, was half a centimeter? Now it's 17 centimeters. If you want to contain... jumping ahead of myself. Remember in this, we had sort of, you deposit a little bit of energy, and then it peaks, and then it goes down. Similar thing for hadrons. The peaking happens sort of 2.5 interaction lengths in, so, you know, maybe half a meter into the detector.
If you want to contain 95% of your jet, you have to go to 10 interaction lengths. So you have to go almost 2 meters. And in radius, the containment, 95%, is about 17 centimeters. So already you can see the scale of an electromagnetic calorimeter. Hadronic calorimeter. So hadronic calorimeters are massive, because if you want to fully contain a jet, it needs to be big. So hadronic showers are much wider and more penetrating than electromagnetic showers. Here I can just do a little comparison here, just a little cartoon. Imagine you have an electron coming in. Here's my electromagnetic calorimeter. Here's my hadronic calorimeter. Comes in, electron deposits most of its energy in the various layers here. Proton will deposit energy in here, will deposit energy over here. And this is kind of the rough breakdown in terms of where in the calorimeter it deposits the energy. So for example, this one here in blue, in the blue, that's how much energy is deposited in the electromagnetic calorimeter. And you can see for hadronic jets, it's already about 40%. So it's a lot. Another big difference, remember I said for electron, if you have 100 GeV electron, looks like another 100 GeV electron, looks like another GeV electron. Not the case here, because there's so much going on, it all depends on how lucky or unlucky you are in the very first interactions here. So here I have a pi zero being produced really early, but maybe you don't. Maybe they get produced later on. So a 100 GeV jet does not look like another 100 GeV jet does not. So there's huge fluctuations from one jet to another. So that's the big difference between electrons and jets. And just to say that if you wanted to measure all of the energy coming from a jet, because you have a lot of particles being produced, if you wanted to collect 95% of everything that's here, you need to go down to energies about GeV, each particle to at least 1 GeV, to collect everything. Okay, that was a little summary between electrons and jets.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, no worries. That's so why you're here.
For the electromagnetic prongs in the hadronic jets, mm-hmm. are jet grooming algorithms used for those parts, or are they also taken into account?
So you can use jet algorithms. They're not so much used, I don't think, to look for electromagnetic parts. What they're used often is to look if there's a substructure to the jet. So for example, if there are two things happening close to each other within a jet, so you can separate the things. That's mostly what they're used for, not so much for, you know, pulling out the electron part of the jet. And you don't really want, because you can correct for all of that. Yeah.
Can I please go to the most simplified image of that detector?
Mm-hmm.
So like, let's say a muon can detect in the muon chamber, right? But it has to go through the electrocalorimeter, and so how do we measure that, how much energy is lost in between these three regions?
Yeah, and in fact, it's a very good point. The muons, I mean, it was a gross oversimplification. The muons go through magically all these calorimeters and then go through the muon chamber where you see them. Actually, muons do deposit some of their energy. Not much, though. Usually it's about order of a few GeV, so about 3 GeV of the muon's energy. It's different. I mean, it depends also on the energy of the muon to start off with. But it's usually a few GeV. And the muon, being a charged particle, also leaves a trace in the inner part of the detector. So you can actually... You can use, for example, the information that you see the muon in the inner part, and then you see it again on the outside to have a good constraint as to what the momentum was, because you have part of it at the beginning and then you have part of it at the end. So yes, indeed, you have to correct for that. It's a few GeV. Yeah. All right, Atlas, 7,000 tons. That's heavy. It needs to sit on something, right? Then if you think about it, okay, I told you my calorimeter has liquid argon. It's a cryogenic liquid. So I need to get a cryogenic liquid into my detector. And then these are detectors, so I need to get power to them. So there's high voltage. There's also low voltage to run the electronics. And then, of course, a detector is kind of useless unless you can pull the signal out and interpret the signal. So it means that you need to provide what we call services to the detector. So the detector, first of all, sits on infrastructure, like feet, and that serve no purpose other than to support the detector. And then you need to feed it stuff, power, you need to take stuff out. And the only way you can do that is basically by drilling holes in your detector, or you design it that way so that you have holes in your detector to bring cables in, to bring cables out. So it means that the detector itself is not perfectly hermetic. And those of you who were paying attention, the y-axis here is, this is a simulation, this is truth energy. So if you had a Monte Carlo, it told you exactly, the Monte Carlo knows everything, it's 100 GeV jet, reconstructed energy. This is how much we actually measure of that energy in the detector. And that's 80%. So we actually lose about 20% of the information just because we have a detector.
That's just the electromagnetic energy.
This is the jet electromagnetic energy. So there's on top of that, of course, the hadronic energy. But now I'm going to show this plot here, which gives you the whole thing. And you can see that even if you have a particle that's going right in the center here of the detector going out, you do lose a certain amount of energy just because you have stuff that gets in the way, stuff that's supporting the detector. And if you were to follow this, you follow it along, and you see all kinds of, whoa, what are all these dips and going on here? Well, you can trace that to the holes that we have in our detector to bring in power and to take out the signal. So for example, here we have a dip here at eta is equal to 1. And then that's a dip here that is related to, here it is here. We have right here services. You can see here this little open space here. And then if you keep going, you got, oh, another big dip here at a is about 2.5, 3. And that is the transition between the central part of our detector here and the end cap part of the detector. So that's that space right here. And then as you go to the very tips of the detector, remember, eta 0, 1, 2.5, 5, you're getting right to the end of the detector. And then you realize the detector is really not very hermetic. Now, often we're told, oh, just give me your data. Why do I need to be part of that list? Just give me your data. Yeah, I can give you my raw data, but unless you understand really well what's happening in the detector, that data is useless to you because you need to know the geometry of the detector. So we spend a lot of effort building a description, building a description of our detector. Right down to where do the cables sit, et cetera. And so effectively, if I measure a particle in my detector, I need to effectively correct by 1/1 what you see there in order to get what was the true energy of the particle in the first place, just because there's so much stuff that's in the way. So you do have jet energy response that varies by up to 30% or so, depending on where you are in the detector. I should move on a little bit faster here because I'm chatting too much. Okay, this is what you're interested in. This is where you draw your Feynman diagrams. Some people are actually interested in this level here, not the parton level, but really at the particle level. If you're looking at, you know, pions and kaons, what's happening at this level? That is what I measure in my detector, the energy deposited, so the hadrons and the photons that deposit energy. So I measure this. With my simulation, I can correct back to this level here, or I can also correct back to this level here. So sometimes you'll see in papers parton level jets or particle level jets. But this is the information that we get straight out of the detector. And to get from there to there, I just want to give you some examples of things you have to worry about. Yeah, this is what we're really interested in. But then, you know, you measure stuff and you realize, remember we talked about calorimeters, they have to be long enough to contain the shower. If you're unlucky, maybe the shower is going to spill out the end of the calorimeter and you lose that information. So that needs to be corrected for. Calorimeters sometimes have problems. The power doesn't work, so you have to turn off little bits of your calorimeter for a while. And if it's turned off, you can't measure energy that goes in there. We talked about pileup yesterday. Remember pileup? Remember how I said there was in-time pileup, but there's also out-of-time pileup? How different bunch crossings are working their way through the detector at different times? That can impact the information that's in the calorimeter, because you might have information from two different bunch crossings in the calorimeter at the same time. So anyway, these are all kinds of issues that you have to deal with before you can actually get to over here. And we try to address this by different levels of factorization, in the sense meaning, all right, I'm going to look at this experimental effect, I'm going to measure its impact, now I'm going to look at the next experimental impact, the next effect, and then I just sort of bring all these components together, all these factors together, to correct for it. Okay, now I just, one of the things I want to also mention, because I've been talking about electrons and jets, I also wanted to about invisible particles. Now we have true invisible particles, like neutrinos. We have in things of interest to us, for example, W bosons decay to muon and a neutrino. And that neutrino is gone. So all we're going to see in our detector is the muon. We're not going to see the W boson. And you can already see that the muon is kind of a vague reflection of what's happening in the W, but it's not a complete reflection because part of the information is gone. Higgs bosons also decay to Ws, which then decay to things that have neutrinos. So if you want to look for beyond standard model physics, dark matter and things like that, that may have particles that escape undetected, the first thing you need to do is make sure you understand really well all the standard model processes that produce particles that go undetected. And then you have fake sources of missing energy. Maybe your detector is broken and a particle went through it. Remember, we showed that there's cracks in the detector where you have the surfaces. If you're unlucky enough, maybe a particle went right through the crack. So you didn't see it go. So it looks like it's not there, but it really is. It just, you weren't able to detect it. I've mentioned many times transverse energy, transverse momentum. And it's a nice plane to work in. Just because there we have additional constraints. So we can use conservation of energy and momentum. So if I look my collision like this, I can have multiple collisions, right? Here we go, multiple bunch crossings. Now let's look in the transverse direction. I'm going to go in the transverse direction. So what's happening in the transverse direction right now? Nothing. Nothing, 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 nothing. Collides, all kinds of particles. You had nothing before, so the net stuff that you measure in the transverse plane has to also be zero, just conservation of energy and momentum. So all the particles that are produced in the transverse plane, here's a nice ZDEE event. If you were to add all of these up, you know, look at the directions, the momentum, etc., the net energy, or net momentum, I guess energy is a bad word to say, the net momentum of all of this in the transverse plane should be zero. So you can use that as a constraint. So this is great. For particles where you don't expect anything to be escaping, no neutrinos, that should be basically zero, the net sum. All right, so this is called missing transverse energy or momentum, because we're sloppy again. Energy, because the energy tends to be measured in the calorimeter, but it's in the transverse plane. So here's a little event where we have lots of stuff going on. Here's an event in the transverse plane where you have an electron being produced, maybe some jets, some photons, a muon, and then something escaped, like a neutrino. And we know that the net sum of all these things should be zero in the transverse plane. So if you want to constrain what's missing in the event, so what's going out of the event, the first thing you need to do is you need to sort of say, okay, I'm going to look at this part here. Hey, that looks like an electron. Okay, so I'm going to consider this to be the electron. So I measure the in the x and y direction. Then I look at the other things. I see a photon, so I need to calibrate this. It's a photon. I'm going to add the photon to my sum here. And then you do that for everything that you see in the event. And then we have this kind of sloshy leftover called soft term, or the soft stuff. This is stuff in the event that it's hard to tell if it, what it came from. Was it an electron or muon? Maybe just a bunch of tracks. And so we lump all this stuff there in the soft term. And then you take the negative vectorial sum of all of this, and whatever is left over is you're missing. There you go, is what's missing. So this would tell you what's missing in the event. So this is a very hard quantity. The first thing you want to do is you want to calibrate it. You want to make sure things, events, processes where you don't expect to have anything missing should give you zero in this quantity. So for example, you can look at a Z to mu mu event. This is the X component of missing energy. And you can see it's well centered at zero. This in red is the Z to mu mu. Now, there's no such thing as perfect Z to mu mu because nobody comes again with a name tag saying, hi, I'm a Z. You have a whole bunch of other stuff that's sort of sneaking in. It kind of looks like a Z, but maybe not entirely. So if you, for example, a TT bar event that's in dark blue, some aspects of it can look rather Z-like because a TT bar, maybe one of the tops decayed producing a muon. The T bar decayed itself also producing a muon. Hey, you have a muon anti-muon pair, and you're unlucky enough to make it look like a Z. But mostly you can see in the X and the Y directions that this is nicely centered at zero. And the width of this tells you how good your approximation is when you're measuring this missing transverse momentum. And then you can confront that to processes where you do expect to see missing energy, so coming from the neutrino. This is a W to E nu. And I want you to see the scale of things. Here the scale of things is 100 GV TV. So we use processes that we know well to sort of calibrate what this ET miss should be. And once you understand this really well, then you go and say, okay, do I see new standard model particles? Is there a question? Yeah.
So for like a top decay where I assume you would be expecting some electron track, we use these benchmarks to just assume what the missing transverse energy of the jet is?
So what it's useful for is a lumped sum. So it tells you what is left over. Whoops. Why is this not working?
It's on the left. We're showing up all.
Whoops. Okay.
We have the hockey stick here,
Brian. Yeah, here marks my hockey stick. There we go. Gretzky. This one here. So if there were two neutrinos, you wouldn't be able to say there are two neutrinos. And for a TT bar event, I would expect often two neutrinos to come out. All you do is sort of see the sum of them. If there were 12 neutrinos coming out of the event, all you would see is kind of the sum of the things, all right? So it just gives you globally the sum of the things. So for a top, if you're looking for a top event where you expect to see neutrinos, one of the ways to select top is say, I want electron, I want a muon, and I want missing energy to represent all the neutrinos in the event. So it is a powerful thing to identify other particles. Now you want to come back. Remember the very first slide I said, what inspires me? Dark matter. So now, dark matter, we're in a position to answer the question, how can you see something you can't see? So dark matter can be weakly interacting. Basically, it doesn't emit light, doesn't interact with most of the interactions. The fundamental forces. But I have a powerful ally by my side. I have conservation of energy and momentum. And now we have also missing transverse energy. So if I have two protons, let's say I have two protons interacting and then producing two other particles that I can detect in my detectors, maybe two muons. Now let's produce something. You have two protons interacting and then producing something that escapes and something that's detected. This could be a signal for dark matter. And in fact, we look for that, and here is a beautiful event display that looks just like a dark matter candidate. Look at that. In the transverse plane, whole bunch of stuff, and that dotted line is that missing ET. When you add up everything that's in the transverse plane, basically it's telling you there's nothing going in this direction. But conservation of energy and momentum tells us that something quite powerful went in that direction. So this is a nice candidate for dark matter. And you would say, listen, he says, woohoo, we've discovered dark matter. Cool, I can go home now and retire. I can retire. You can't retire. But I can almost retire. Not quite, but I can almost retire. The reality of it is, it's just a candidate event. So it's an event that looks like dark matter. And you now, as good phenomenologists, would say, but wait a second. We can't say this is dark matter until, what have we done? We've ruled out all possible standard model sources that would look like this. So, for example, here is it's called PT recoil. Basically, it's a measure of all the momentum that you see in this direction here. The dotted lines are what you measure. So the dotted points here, which look perfect, but what you measure. And then the colored lines are all perfectly plausible standard model sources of things that can give you something that looks like that. The number one thing that can give you something like that is this red-orange thing here. And you look at that, it's a standard model process. It's a Z boson plus a jet. The Z decays to two neutrinos. So the Z is produces two neutrinos. What happens to neutrinos? They're out of there. So what you have is you have a perfectly good Z boson that was produced here, and you were unlucky enough that it produced a neutrino, antineutrino, that went that way. And then on the other side, it's just a jet. So it does look like dark matter, but it's also completely consistent with something that you would see from the standard model. So here's the ratio of what we see in data with what is the standard model expectation. And if you wanted to see dark matter, you would want to see some deviation here. There's a little bit of a deviation here, but it's not very big given the uncertainties here. So sadly, we have not seen any dark matter yet at the LHC. I do want to point out to you that neutrinos are very common. And as we sit here in this room, about 100 trillion of them are passing through your body every second coming from the sun. Fortunately for you, they don't even notice you. A neutrino could go through a light year of lead and go, la, 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 la. Oh, was that lead? Oh, geez, you know, I didn't notice it. So we do produce a lot of them, but they just don't interact. I do want to mention a few I would call exciting sources of invisible particles. You know that supersymmetry is something that we want to look for, and we have been looking for. In particular, okay, let me just say, supersymmetry, often you end up having, if you have a proton-proton interaction producing some sort of supersymmetric particle coming out, what often comes out of there are kind of almost like a democratic production of jets and leptons, and potentially this thing called the lightest supersymmetric particle, a neutralino, which could be, yes.
What you said made me think of, there's a trillion neutrinos that walk into a bar.
Yeah.
One of them says, ouch.
Yes. Yes. Yes, one could ask the question, what does a neutrino drink? But okay. In Canada, probably drink the beer. So in supersymmetry, I mean, we are interested in, for example, in this neutralino, because that's a perfectly good source of dark matter. It's a particle, it's weakly interacting, and it could add up to be the dark matter in the universe. So that's why we would love to see this. Another example, so missing energy is a great way to find this. Another one that was interesting is, if you're looking for extra dimensions, you might have a graviton that's being produced. And so again, you have the same sort of geometry. You have a bunch of jets of particles recoiling against this thing called the graviton that is undetected. So there are very exciting sources of non-standard model particles that could mimic that, but you have to understand first the standard model versions of them. Okay, I'm just going to skip the supersymmetry here, because I want to talk a little bit about, somebody yesterday asked, wait a second, aren't you cheating? You're using the very particles you want to study to calibrate your detector. Yes, it's true. But there are some signatures, potentially signatures of new physics, that are really interesting, that they're very hard to calibrate because they don't look like a normal proton-proton interaction. I have two examples here, which is really lovely. I love this one here. For example, let's say you have a long-lived particle. Maybe it's a gluino, forms our hadron. So, you know, you have a proton-proton collision, travels for a while, and then it just sort of stops in the middle of your calimeter and goes la 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 la, decay. So it hangs out in your calimeter for a while and decays. So the first thing you lose is directionality, because, you know, when you have a particle that's produced and it goes in that direction and interacts with the calorimeter, you can maybe trace its path. But if it's just sitting there for a while and then decays, it decays isotropically. So you have an interesting signature of large out-of-time energy deposits. The other thing is it's very hard to trigger on events like this because they're not really associated to an interaction, a bunch crossing. So to try and detect this kind of signature is very interesting. Another type of signature that's really interesting is this one here. It's called a disappearing track. Maybe you have a chargino being produced, travels a little bit through maybe your inner detector, produces a very soft pion. It's so soft, it just, you know, fritters away inside your detector. You don't actually see it. And it turns into a neutralino. So from the perspective of a detector, it looks like you had a charged particle that went through the detector and then poof, disappeared. You don't see it anymore. So it's a disappearing track that leaves some trace of its path inside the detector, but not outside the detector. So these are two different really interesting topologies that we try to, best as we can, keep our eyes open to look for this kind of stuff. And we have actually different strategies. So on the left-hand side is the process I said a moment ago on the left-hand side, and on the right-hand side is the process on the right-hand side. So this gluino, we've looked at it. So we have different strategies depending on how far it might have traveled before it decided to decay. And so we are sensitive at some level. It could have traveled and decayed in the beam pipe. So very close, like less than a few centimeters. Maybe it could decayed inside the inner part of the detector. Maybe it decayed in the calorimeter. Maybe it decayed in the muon spectrometer. And that's kind of the range over which we have tried to keep some sensitivity to be able to see that signature. Similarly, for this signature here, if the chargino decays in the inner detector, this is where we have the most sensitivity. We should also have some sensitivity in the calorimeter. So these are just two examples of really funky signatures that they are hard to calibrate because they don't look like what you would expect from the standard model. All right, physics at the LHC and in other places. We kind of do two types of things at the LHC. We measure with precision properties of known particles. And the reason why we measure with precision is we want to confront it to theory and see, look for deviations. So here we have the mass of the Higgs boson, which we've measured in multiple ways. Higgs boson decaying to 4 leptons or 2 photons. With our first set of data, run 1, our second set of data, run 2, we put them together, etc. And you have effectively independent measurements of the Higgs boson. And then you can even go across the ring and you say, hey, CMS, how about we join forces? If we put our information together, what do we get for the Higgs boson? So we measure it with precision to be about 125 GeV with a very small uncertainty. It's about a quarter of a GeV. So that's what we do, and we measure it, and then we confront it with the theory, which I think the theory is probably this gray band here. Now, the Higgs boson is getting to be kind of passé in some sense. It's no longer like, ooh, it's Higgs boson. It's like, ah, oh, Higgs boson, it's just like any other particle, right? Now it's our workhorse to do other stuff. The next frontier for us is to see two Higgs bosons. So Brian was mentioning this morning, you know, the self-interaction of the Higgs boson. That would be like really interesting to measure. And it might even be in reach at the LHC. So we are looking for that. So here's a candidate of, it's an event that meets all the requirements of coming from two Higgs bosons. One of them decays to BB bar, and the other one decays to two photons. I'm going to be showing you, and I've been showing to you, a bunch of event displays like this. But in an event display like this, the way that you would interact it is your protons come in from either end, and then they interact there in the center, producing jets and photons, for example, in this case. And in fact, all our event displays, as I've been showing, now we can understand why they look the way they look. Because if you have a photon or an electron, it deposits most of its energy early in the calorimeter. If you have a jet, on average, it deposits its energy more spread out. Muons make it completely out of the detector. So this is kind of the anatomy of a standard event display. All right, what kind of physics might you see at the LHC? All right, so you have two protons colliding. Out comes a Z boson, and maybe on the other side, you have some quark and a gluon. So that's our hard scattering that we've been talking about. What we see in the detector, now that we know about missing energy, we know that, for example, on the left-hand side here, this is a W decay. We have the muon coming from the W. And this is actually a candidate of a W and a photon being produced. There's your photon. Didn't leave any trace in the inner detector because it's uncharged. There's your muon making its way out. And then looking at missing transverse energy, the dotted line gives you effectively the direction of the neutrino, even though you don't actually see the neutrino. And I promised to you yesterday to tell you what the half-life of these W's and Z. It's about 10 to the minus 25 seconds. So even if you're traveling at the speed of light, you're not going to go very far. Right. So this is an event with a neutrino. This is an event where everything should balance really nicely. So you can see the difference between the two. All right, so you have collisions. They look like that. But one hopes that also in these collisions, you have stuff that's happening here that are non-standard. So things that are unexpected. And you could ask the question, well, if you see a J psi producing two muons and you see a Z producing two muons, maybe if you go high enough energy, there's a new particle that also produces two muons. And we search for that as well. So the Z boson on this scale would be right about here. And then we look, just looking at the invariant mass of two muons, we look everywhere else for a bump. And darn, there's like no bumps. It's just beautiful. I mean, it's, what is it, 6-7 orders of magnitude. This is what it would look like if there were bumps. So if there were a Z boson that had a mass of 2 TeV or 5 TeV, you would see enhancements here. But the data, which is the dotted points here, don't support this idea of enhancements there. And so what you do when you don't see any enhancements, you don't detect a new particle, you can say, well, I looked and I didn't see a new type of particle up to a range of, say, 5 TeV. So the data here doesn't support the idea of having a new type of particle. The other way to say it is, if that type of particle does exist, its mass has to be higher than, you know, the reach of what your detector, your data says, which is about 5 TeV in this case. So I want to introduce to you another person, physics coordinator Pamela. Apart from the spokesperson of our experiment, she is the most powerful person in ALICE. I'm just an avatar for our spokesperson. She decides our entire physics program. She is responsible for saying, all right, I think that Higgs boson physics, we should really focus on that. That, you know, it's kind of been ruled out. Do we really want to spend some energy looking at, some effort looking at this type of new phenomena? So she is the one who steers our entire program. She's also one who's responsible if our program doesn't work well. So she has a lot of on her shoulders. So this type of position is usually not to a postdoc, just because you need a lot of physics experience to be able to have a good judgment. So she's a professor, or she's a chief of research. NICEF is a national lab in the Netherlands. She's Italian, working in the Netherlands. And just to wrap up what I wanted to say today, just kind of a summary of how we look for stuff, and then tomorrow I'll start talking about real physics that we do at the LHC. Just to say that particles are created as a result of these collisions. We use different layers of our detector to give us different information as to where these particles come from and what they are. Because we're effectively colliding bags of marbles, a proton, with another bag of marbles, which is another proton, the interpretation can be really challenging. We use our triggers to filter out the uninteresting events, you know, so that we can really focus on the things we want to look at. The most interesting stuff, the Higgs boson, the W and the Z, decay almost immediately. And all we really see is the stuff they decay to. So if you were interested in the Higgs boson, you're not going to see Higgs boson in the detector. Here's a trace of what's happening. The Higgs boson's actually decaying right at the center of our beam pipe here. And all you see is the stuff that's come out. So if you want, think about it this way. It's like you're taking a plate, you're breaking it apart. You don't see the plate falling. You just see the bits moving out. And then you use conservation of energy and momentum to figure out that it was a plate in the first place, and that plate is in fact the Higgs boson. So you see these things, you built the invariant mass of that, and that invariant mass, if it keeps coming back saying it's 125, you look at another event, it's 125 again, you know that you're seeing a bunch of Higgs bosons or candidates of Higgs bosons. Now, I'm gonna come here because I often have to restart this animation. I don't know why it's weird. It always works when I'm at home, but when I do it in an audience, it always crashes in. So I have a movie which shows it's the invariant mass of four leptons. So basically you take four leptons, you add them all up, and you want to see if something comes out. So it is an invariant mass of four leptons. And what it does is it takes you from the beginning of ATLAS in the LHC, and it just adds one event at a time. So there's a date, so it tells you, 10 days after we start taking data, this is how many events we had, 20 days, et cetera. And from that, you'll see merging the Higgs boson. Now, we know that from the Higgs boson, there are things that can mimic Higgs boson. First of all, you can get just 2Z that have nothing to do with Higgs boson. They're just producing 2Z. So that'll appear as a background in red. You can also have a Z plus jets because the jet can mimic a Z boson, and it kind of looks like you have two Z bosons. So, you ready? We're going to see the Higgs boson appear, and it better work. Okay, let's go back up here. Let's try that again. Here we go. All right. Here are the look at the date up there, October 2021. The data points in black and red and purple are the background events. You see stuff happening. What's going on here? The data way overestimates what the standard model background is. Look at that, and you can see the ratio here, or the difference. But if you have 125 GeV Higgs boson, it fits. So you can see the date here. This was basically at the end of 20. Right, it's going to do it again. At the end of 2012, which is effectively when we really had a good signal for Higgs boson. So you can see the other stuff. You might think that was the Higgs boson, but it's not. It's background. But you can see how a signal emerges by comparing what you measure with what the expectation was at the time, assuming there was no Higgs boson. And you can see very nicely the Higgs boson appearing right here.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
There's also an excess on the right.
On the right here?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it depends a little bit on the kinematics of how you select. This is probably a background that grows four leptons here. You would have to sort of see what else is happening here. Also, we select the events to try and highlight this region here. And in fact, in the next lecture, I'll be talking a little bit about what's happening here. So you do skew what you see just because you're selecting, you're making requirements so as to enhance what's happening exactly here, which can sculpt the background. And this is where I'm going to stop today. But before I do that, I don't know if any of you noticed this, but I did a gratuitous, if I can find it, where is it? It's right. There we go. I don't know. There we go. I had a gratuitous little drawing here, which has nothing to do with the LHC. This is old school bubble chamber event. In the days when you actually used your eyes to look at what's happening, you take photographs, from all these curly things, you can see a lot of different, so these are all charged particles that are going through magnetic fields, so they curl, and as they curl, they are losing photons, so they're radiating, so they lose energy, and so they spiral down. So this is a beautiful event display of the days. Now, I have here your second present. This is the last one. You're not getting any more presents tomorrow. So I have a colleague of mine who's retired now, but in the 1970s, worked on a bubble chamber experiment. It was at CERN. It was called the CERN 2-meter long bubble chamber experiment. It was liquid hydrogen. And in that experiment, they used 4GV kaon beams. And then they would look at, this is not it, but they would look at what's happening when a 4GV kaon beam decays in the bubble chamber. This is October 1974. And in those days, literally, you took photos. You know, you'd say, an event, snap. And then when he retired, he brought me these, you know, ancient donut tapes of film, photographic film. He says, well, I'm retiring. Do you want them? I said, well, yeah. So I've been laboriously cutting out one event at a time, and I have a bunch of events. Every single one of them is different. Now, if you're lucky, you'll see lots. Oh, this one has nice. Oh, it's got nice Vs in there. This one's pretty nice. Some of them are more exciting than others. Now, if there's nothing, it happens sometimes. If there's nothing, then you can take a second one. But, you know, you get what you get. So I'll put half here. And I'll put the other half here and come down and help yourself to history, 1974.